Welcome to this interview. I'm Megan Gibson, your conference co-host. Today, I'm speaking with Lee Harbor, a member of the psychology team at the Optimum Health Clinic. He originally engaged with the clinic as a patient back in 2016 after suffering from ME/CFS. It was through this journey that he became aware that he had no relationship with his emotions and the trauma that he was carrying. Through therapy and joining the therapeutic coaching practitioner training, Lee was offered a role at the clinic. Shortly after, he discovered he's autistic and has ADHD, something he calls a huge revelation and a real catalyst for stepping into himself and finding comfort in who he is. While working at the clinic, he started to see common themes in neurodivergent individuals that he experienced in his own journey and developed practical ways of supporting people from a place of intrinsic value and reversing the theme of being broken or wrong with the central question of what if it was okay to be you? Lee Harbor, thank you so much for being with us today. I wanted to start with, how do you view ADHD?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question and also quite a huge question to try to answer. But I think I like to try and make it as simple as possible. So rather than kind of going into it, because I think it is a complex thing or a complex way of being in the world, but I think it can be really helpful to have like one simple central focal point who then bounce off, not as a way to avoid the complexity, but one that can hold it. So this is the way I kind of view actually all neurodivergence. I try to bring it back as essentially all the way I see it is underlying all of it is a different, I guess, a non-typical sensory experience of being in the world. And depending then on the makeup of that non-typical sensory experience in the world, that then leads to different behaviors that would then be termed as autistic or ADHD or Tourette's or dyslexia. So the way I see ADHD is one flavor of that non-typical sensory experience of being in the world. And I guess some of the pieces that make that up, I would say, is also another way of looking at it, is that our brains filter out essentially the information in the world. Our brains are what dictates what comes in, what doesn't come in, or what pace it comes in. And I think what can be universally, but commonly seen in ADHD is that almost the filter is very open. So lots comes in and it can feel very now. So I guess an example of that can be that, say, turning up to work in the morning, there can just be a sense of all of a sudden everything that needs to be done that day can just become very immediate in your mind. And there can be the sense of like, this is all here now and I have to do this now. So it's almost like I think that can be a helpful way of seeing the filtering of information. And with ADHD, there's often that just it all comes in and it all feels very immediate. And then that in itself is a very overwhelming experience. And then what we then see is ADHD traits, I think, are then a reaction to that discomfort of just everything coming in and how to process that. And I think alongside that, there's also just different ways of seeing the world as well. So when you've got more information or less information, or it's coming in a different way, you will then potentially see things differently to those around you. So ADHD people can be very creative and have different views and different ideas. So I see it as a non-typical sensory experience in the world, and then a non-typical kind of layering of filtering of how that comes in.
I love that. I mean, yeah, no, absolutely. And also it reminds me just of, you know, when we have the trauma conference, it's not a joke, but the thing that I always say with amusement is that I've interviewed hundreds of people about trauma, and I always start with, you know, what is trauma? And I get hundreds of different answers, not because there isn't an answer, but because each person answers that based on their lens, their area of expertise, their experience, right? And so it's not that there's one answer, that any answer is wrong, or that if you can't define it one way, that it's not a real thing. It's that every person's going to have a different experience with it. And while some things are overarchingly true diagnostically, the interpretation, as you were just speaking to as well, like your experience, and then the interpretations out of that non-typical experience are going to weigh in on what your conclusions are and how your behavior is affected, right?
Yeah, because I guess I what's interesting about how I guess I viewed it is that I because so I'm ADHD and autistic myself, and kind of came I'm not someone, it's interesting, I'm a very curious person, but from a kind of like what's my experience of it. So I kind of done like a deep dive into what's my actual experience, like what's actually happening here. And I haven't really done much research around the literature and the science around it. So I'm actually a bit naive when it comes to the kind of science of ADHD, but I think that gives a really nice perspective of then just actually what is my experience and how do I experience that? And then through working at the clinic, working with a number of neurodivergent clients, I was just seeing that lived experience was very co there were, you know, common themes that were occurring again and again and again. So I was like, okay, so this isn't just my ADHD experience. This is the same as other people. And then I have read wider around the literature and then, you know, view different, say, accounts on Instagram, and again, it's the same experience, just given, as you say, different lenses, different words, but it's essentially the same thing we're all trying to describe. I guess it's because it is multifaceted. You can then also come at it from different angles. So it's we're all talking about the same thing. It's just how we describe the thing is using a different set of words that then, I guess, land in a different way. And the reason why I lean more towards that kind of experiential piece is because really, your experience is the only thing you do know is real and do know is there. And what underlies a lot of ADHD and I think neurodivergence is a lack of trust in your experience. And if you can bring people back to really being curious of their experience and rebuilding trust in their experience, it's quite an empowering shift as well. So I don't intentionally avoid the science. I think it just keeps, for me, on a practical level, it becomes more pragmatic to just work with the experience. So that's not negating any of the other viewpoints because I think they're totally valid and I have done reading into them as well. It's just, yeah, I think this lens is quite useful for actually yeah, genuinely helping someone in actually navigating their experience as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And so much of what you've already said, especially you earlier said something about kind of when you come into work and there's all of these tasks to be done that day and kind of the overwhelm of all of that and the inability to kind of sort and prioritize and manage what needs to be done. I thought of, like the feedback that managers sometimes will give to people when they're being evaluated and it's, doesn't know how to prioritize tasks. Well, that seems pretty unfair if you have a neurodivergent mind. It's like, yeah, that's how my brain works. I'm going to need some assistance in doing that because my brain is not necessarily incapable, but that's just not how my brain works. That's not the strength of my brain. And so I say that just to ask about kind of the second separation wound, as you call it, and the trauma that can sometimes come with ADHD, AD, I just ADHD, you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, well, I think it sets up like a shame cycle. So I think, as you say, like going back to that, so in psychology, it's like known that, well, it's often written about that we have this sort of separation wound in childhood where we the moment we recognize that we aren't one with our mum, but we aren't one with our environment, we are a separate being. And in acknowledging you're a separate being, things can start, you can start to recognize that things become conditional. You start to get that sense of like, oh, okay, if I do this, I'm loved. If I don't do this, then I'm not loved. And that's seen as a very big piece, you know, that people work through that trauma essentially for their whole life. There's always things going on. And think the second, whereas with a neurodivergent mind, you go through that and then you start to notice like, well, actually, people don't experience me the way I experience the world. And you start going to school and your peers see things differently, or they find things really easy that you find really hard. And you just start to notice, get this kind of pervasive feeling of I'm different. And that I'm different very quickly turns into, well, I'm wrong. And then that what that does is it shuts down all curiosity. And especially, you know, when you're a child, it's really hard to be introspective. You can't be introspective and curious. But what it does is it shuts down that sense of even knowing that there's something wrong and that you might even need to ask for help. So you just start pushing through and masking essentially. So you cover up that you're different. And then within that, no one really knows you're different or struggling. So all you get, as you say, is those things of like, oh, could do with better timekeeping, isn't organized, fidgets too much, talks too much, is distracted easily. So it just creates this further deepening of like, I'm wrong, I'm wrong, I can't do this properly, I need to be better. And then what I often see, I guess, at the clinic are people that have been diagnosed as adults, like I was myself. And at that point, people come in and say, I was there myself, this sense of needing to be fixed. Like I thought I was totally wrong and broken, and was like, and I can spot it straight away. People will say things like, I need someone to whip me into shape. I need someone to give me a good kick up the backside. And like, oh, okay, I think they might. Straight away, I kind of start getting a sense of like someone that's that kind of harsh on themselves. And then I think going to the experience, like going back to the office example, the way you can start, you can, the rejection can just happen in every moment through the day. It becomes so deep and entrenched that your whole day is literally just lived in shame and frustration. Where perhaps, so often people with ADHD say struggle to go to bed on time. So you wake up in the morning before work, you're tired, you're already angry with yourself because you didn't go to bed early enough. And then you can't find your car keys to leave. So then you're late for work because you've been struggling to find anything all the way on the way to work. You're telling yourself what an idiot you are because you lost your car keys. You get into work and then you're already overwhelmed. And then you're hit with the task of the day and it's this sense of overwhelm. So you've got the genuine overwhelm of the sensory experience, but then you've got this layer of constant judgment, constant needing to fix yourself. That's another layer of stress. And it's that cycle that just, you are just swilling around in shame and trauma. Essentially, you're kind of re-traumatizing yourself perpetually through that experience.
Yeah, and that's really the lens through which and why we're talking about this is this kind of stress cycle, whether it be outside induced, inside induced. And I think about, you talked about when you get diagnosed, and I think even if a child has an intervention early, I say that word intervention, I don't mean like a bunch of people coming together. I mean, like intervention and in trying to help a child succeed and get them the support that they need. You don't have that self objective evaluative characteristic that you would by the time you're in your mid 20s, just like you were just saying. Like, you can't reflect upon your neurodivergence as this thing that just makes your brain work. All you can think is, I struggle in class and everybody makes fun of me, or whatever the situation is. And it's not until adulthood. So, regardless of when you get diagnosed, in adulthood, there's still a reckoning to be made in your relationship to the ADHD, right?
Yeah, and it's your whole relationship to yourself, really. I think it's so I guess, yeah, to think about that stress cycle, if you're constantly rejecting yourself, you're just creating cortisol and adrenaline, you're creating those stress hormones that are just, moving through you, and then that makes tasks even more difficult. So you've already got this difficult sensory experience in the world, and now you've got the additional difficulty of judging yourself all day. And then you've got the third difficulty of the constant stress hormones that are also very uncomfortable to have moving through your body. And I think it's that piece of the first step you can make to changing your relationship with yourself is a place of like you're making sense of your experience. Because if people just sort of see ADHD as just a list of symptoms, it doesn't really explain why they're experiencing those symptoms. So there's still a sense of like, well, what do I do with this? Whereas if you really know, like, oh gosh, actually, loads, so much information comes in my brain, but it makes sense that I find it really hard to remember when to put where I put my keys, because actually my brain is doing a million things and it doesn't really care where I put my keys. Or if you get so excited by something that your brain just gets hooked on it and then you don't go to bed on time. And it's kind of like making sense that, okay, maybe I, so starting to make sense of the way you're behaving or reacting or showing up in the world is the first step of being able to kind of accept yourself. And a couple of examples I've had with people is often you hear people saying that they find it really hard to remain present in a conversation and they feel really bored in a conversation. So they feel like they're awful people for it. Whereas I sort of reframe it as like, well, actually, it sounds like you're trying way harder than the other person to be in the conversation because it's much harder for you. So if you can acknowledge how hard you're working to do supposedly simple things, you can start to give yourself a bit of a break of like, oh, actually, maybe, gosh, actually, these things are really hard. And I think it's what often comes with ADHD is because a lot can be spoken about as in like, think about the positives, what are the positive attributes? And I think that's really important, not from a place of, well, just focus on the positive and the bad stuff will go away. I think it's about
Right,
really
right. Not the
acknowledging
positive
that stuff.
psychology bypassing kind of part. It's the, yeah.
But I think it's about seeing the balance of your whole self of like, okay, there's stuff over here, and we can often focus on the things we can't do well because the way what can often be the picture in ADHD is the things that we can't do well are the stuff that 95% of the population do without thinking. And then there's stuff that we can do incredibly well that only like 2 or 3% of the population can do. And we just park that like it doesn't matter. We're just like, oh no, that doesn't. And it's like, if you can actually be like, well, actually, no, I'm just a fairly fine-tuned like machine that needs. That is actually, I guess, like a sports car. It's like it's really good at doing stuff, but you can't take it on like country roads because it will really struggle. And I don't think that's a perfect metaphor, but it's this idea of like seeing the whole of yourself. And because I've worked with people who are incredibly successful and do some amazing things, yet they're totally hung up about the fact that they can't do their tax return on time, or and they that's what's the focus of their mind. Whereas if you can start to make sense of your experience of like, oh, actually, the reason why I can do this like big picture thinking and I can have this amazing creativity is because my brain lets in loads of information. And then the flip side of that is that it makes small, more menial tasks feel impossible. And if you can really see that, then I guess that's, to me, that's the first step of like, oh, actually, it makes sense that this is my presentation in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And so much of what you're saying and why we're talking about it is because it's important to help other people understand that, like, for me in particular, this is normal. This is a normal experience. And I have two neurodivergent kids, and we're constantly talking about, like, well, it makes sense that you struggle to do this because of XYZ, or this is how your brain works. And they're very differently neurodivergent, just to keep my life interesting. And the one procrastinates a ton. He's incredibly autonomous and very self-sufficient and responsible when it's things he's really, really, really interested in, right? And everything else is going to get procrastinated. And it's a huge form of frustration for him. He hates it. And so to just be able to reframe it for him and be like, okay, this is just part of how, you don't struggle to do this or this or this in great and wonderful ways, but algebra is a struggle for you. Guess why? Because it's not fun. Algebra. It's like, of course, it makes a lot of sense that you struggle to remember to do your algebra homework. Come on, man.
And I think it is that it's like if you it's though and people flog themselves because they're like it's like
Yeah.
my one is like I can't do recurring meetings. If someone tells me a meeting is done fortnightly, I just can't work out. I don't know why. I still don't know that. I just can't work out how to actually. I'll put the first win in and I sit there and I'm like 1 week. It's like, oh, what week is it? I can't work out what week it is. I know I can do lots, and I think it's the incongruity that people really struggle with is that how can it be true that I'm intelligent if I can't do these simple tasks? So I think humans, and I kind of like this from existential psychotherapy, is this idea of being human is one of living in the world in inherent contradictions. And as humans, we want a kind of clean narrative of either I'm a clever person or I'm not a clever person, or I'm a motivated person or I'm not a motivated person. And with ADHD, you get these real contradictions. Like I often have the energy where I want to do something equally as much as I dread doing it. And that's a very weird experience to hold in your body. But if you can start to be open to that, of just, okay, this is my reality and perhaps that's okay. I guess what you start doing is you start shifting from that stress cycle because you're starting to connect. So that's one of disconnecting. And in every moment, we can either choose to, and I guess this is how fragmentation happens. We can either choose to reject our experience and we push it away and we say, no, I don't want that. Or we can become curious and open to it and sort of say, okay, this is difficult, this is uncomfortable, perhaps wish it wasn't this way, but actually I can connect to this and I can open to this and kind of let it in. And it kind of really, and I guess that's the shift and kind of coming back to how like the hormones, you move away from the kind of stress hormones and start moving towards the more kind of connection hormones of kind of oxytocin, serotonin, GABA, and things that kind of make your body feel good and make you feel good in the world rather than leaving you in perpetual stress. And I think that can feel very, sounds very simple to just say, oh, okay, I'll kind of accept this. And I guess the way it works is that if you lose your car, you know, if you can't find your car keys in the morning, rather than giving yourself a hard time all the way to work, what that would look like is you just going like, okay, it's happened again. Not ideal, but it's okay. I've found them now. And it's that kind of just being really patient with yourself and being okay with it. And one of the kind of stumbling blocks to that is that because there can be, what I've seen a lot, and this I certainly saw it in myself as well, because there can be such a lack of trust in the underlying self. One of the objections that always comes up to this is like, well, actually, well, but then I'll, but I do need to do these things. So if I start accepting myself, then I'll completely go off the rails and I'll be complete. I'll never be anywhere on time and I'll be rubbish at this and I'll be rubbish at this. So there's such a fundamental lack of trust of like, and I guess the underlying question is always like, what if it was just okay to be you? And actually what you come up against there is like, no, it's absolutely not okay to be me. I have to make myself better at this. I have to do this. Whereas what I've noticed is the absolute opposite is that when people turn towards themselves and connect, they actually get some space. They can be with their experience. They can breathe. Their body moves into a different physiology and you're just not at war with yourself. So then you are present with the tricky sensory experience in the world, but you haven't got the stress hormones up on top of it. You haven't got the judgment on top of it. You've got the, yeah, so you've kind of taken away a fairly big chunk of what makes things difficult.
I think what you just said is so relatable to so many people, even if they're neurotypical, that feeling of, if I allow this to be true, and if I accept this, then the whole, like the floodgates will open and I won't be able to like stuff it all back. The snakes will be out of the box and I can't put the lid back on. Such a relatable thing in so many different ways. And that self-trust of like letting, opening the box, maybe one snake falls out and you're like, okay, there's a mess, but I can clean it up. We're, you know, talk about bad metaphors. I'm talking about snakes in a box, but we're doing great with our metaphors. But yeah, I can, that self-trust piece, especially if you've encountered just like daily friction with the outside world and the way that you work and your inside environment and how you're relating to yourself. I'm sure we're talking like micro acceptance acts every day and self-trust, huh?
Yeah, I think it has to start small. And I think part of the saying it has to is I don't know if this will always be the case with everybody, but what I notice is that you start to reverse the shame cycle, but in doing that, the shame comes to the surface. So if you do something differently, so as you start to change and you start to accept yourself, what you might notice is the feelings of shame actually come to the surface, because it's the kind of constant monitoring and flogging of self that is fueled by shame, but it stops you feeling the shame. Whereas when you start to accept yourself, you let the lid off the shame, and then you can start to actually process the shame and the trauma that sits. So it needs to be slowly, in the sense of it's not just a, I don't see it as just like a self-acceptance journey. I do see it as like a trauma healing journey, because you've gone from a place of feeling, you know, I guess talking about different definitions, think definition of trauma is an experience that you're overwhelmed by, you didn't have resources for, and you had no one to talk to about it. Like that completely ticks all the neurodivergent boxes as a child. So, and again, that's to different degrees for different people, but I think it's something to consider. And another piece, you know, another piece that a lot of people with ADHD experience is the kind of resistance to things. So there can be this very physical sense of, I guess what you would call procrastination, but essentially that's kind of resistance to doing something. And the way I kind of like to reframe that is that, well, if you've been told from basically from a young age that when you try and do things, you're doing it wrong or you're stupid, or it's essentially a place in you that's trying to stop you doing these things because it's afraid you're going to be shamed for it. So again, it's like when you're, because some ADHD stuff out there is like, buy this journal that will make lists and stuff. And I imagine on some level that's helpful, but that's still a sense of like there's something to fix. Whereas actually, if you can move toward the resistance of like, okay, maybe it's okay to procrastinate. Can I welcome this procrastination? Again, the fear is like, well, if I welcome the procrastination, I'll never do anything. Whereas actually, it's like it's almost like a message. It is just a message from your body saying, are you sure you want to do this? And if you can really let that through and let it be there, then it is energy, and you can kind of settle. And I guess all of this sounds fairly simple, but to put into action, it is difficult because you are sort of turning the tide of one of moving away from yourself to one of letting it in. But I think it's one of those things that once the idea lands, I think it lands for good. So it can be tricky to get to land and to get to stick, and it can be a tricky journey to unpick. But I think once it's landed, of like, oh, maybe my brain, maybe it makes sense of this, and you start to become curious without even needing to put effort. It is just something that starts to gather its own momentum. But at the beginning, it is like a tanker ship that does need to get turn 180 degrees, and that's a lot of work. But once it's turned, it will just slowly keep going on.
It's funny to hear you describe that because I was actually saying that exact, not that exact example, but this idea of kind of like tiny micro, like millions of micro moments. And then it feels like it happened all at once when we're talking about like the effort to make change and how monumental each tiny movement feels at the very beginning. And then you're like, I don't remember why that was so hard. It feels easier. It's not like it's over. I don't have to deal with it anymore. It's just, that used to feel so hard, and now it doesn't anymore.
Yeah, and I think it's almost like a fundamental rule of change. It's like our brain doesn't want us to change, because our brain is like, even though things aren't perfect, we're surviving. So our brain's like, well, just keep doing it because you're alive. And all you need to do is do something as simple as walk a little bit slower. So start recognizing when your brain's going, why are you doing this? Why are you walking slow? It's like it doesn't take a lot to provoke your brain to kick in and start telling you to go back to not go back to what's normal. So it's, yeah, and I think if you go into it recognizing those rules that, because again, it can be quite disheartening if you do something that's really positive on this journey and actually it leaves you feeling quite uncomfortable. But again, if you can understand that and make sense, there's a like, it'll make sense to feel uncomfortable, then it becomes easier. And then, as you say, once you've moved forward, you look back and you think, oh gosh, made quite a lot of progress. And I really do believe in this approach as well, because something I've seen, what again, another common trend I've seen with people that speak is around all neurodivergence, is that really the key piece that changes things for people is that building self-acceptance. And that doesn't just mean like, can I accept myself for being ADHD? Can I accept myself for being autistic? It's actually the true moments of like being invited to do something and your body going, I absolutely don't want to do that. And you being able to be honest and say, this doesn't work for me. That's self-acceptance. Self-acceptance isn't like looking in the mirror and telling yourself you're great. Self-acceptance is that you do something that that you feel frustrated by, and actually you can accept the frustration. You can accept that things are difficult. You can accept that things are uncomfortable. And within that, it is all about things settle down. So I think it's about, rather than trying to fix anything, it's about kind of letting yourself settle. So you can actually, I guess, assess yourself from your genuine experience in the world rather than just through a lens of your own judgment of yourself in the world.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I want to come back to the hormone piece just for a second, because if somebody is, seeing this session for the first time and they're not clear about all the systems that are impacted by the hormones produced by stress, like how How will you feel that in your body, especially in a neurotypical way? What are all the systems that are impacted by stress via hormones?
Well, I mean, your whole body's affected by stress, and it can be, and it really can be a full body experience. Like if you think about the feeling of overwhelm, it is just a sense of everything is too much, and that can be like a pressure in your head. Your adrenals can even you can even feel them throbbing. You can sometimes feel throbbing through your body because you've got adrenaline and cortisol flowing. You can feel very sort of overly reactive. You can get a hot face, or you can get really cold. You can actually feel frozen. You can feel completely incapacitated, or you can just feel incredibly anxious. So it can show up as anything really that feels like like things are hard. When you're not full of stress hormones, things should just kind of feel okay, and you should feel like you can just flow. And obviously there can be challenges, but you feel okay. Whereas when there's stress hormones, there is this sense of just that this is too much. And sometimes that too much leads you into a hyper arousal of fight or flight. And other times it leads you into a hyper arousal of kind of being sort of shut down. And living in that place perpetually shifts your kind of your balance point in your body. Your nervous system is what kind of sets pace in your body. And if you're constantly in stress, your nervous system just parks itself there. And then that puts a lot of pressure on it. And then all of the symptoms of we see in ADHD just get exacerbated, because living in perpetual stress is almost living in some form of ADHD itself anyway, because you're kind of become hypervigilant, because that's essentially what stress is. Again, you become more vigilant to your surroundings. So more information's coming in, it's coming in quicker, your brain is seeing it as a threat. So it's all the things that just make your experience feel faster and more uncomfortable and intense.
Absolutely. I just wanted to really kind of validate that for people because stress is, it wreaks havoc. Anything that is working to keep you alive, bare minimum, is impacted by stress, your digestion, your breathing rate, like, and you did a great job of explaining to people what that's going to actually feel like your face is flush or you're tingly or like all of those things are happening. They're the things you'll actually notice. And it might take hours for you to notice that, you're not digesting properly and all of the other things that come down the line that aren't necessarily kind of response and reaction. So thank you for outlining all of those.
Yeah, and to take it further, like chronic stress does lead to burnout, and that's my journey. And through this was starting with one of fatigue, but and developed into ME. And I think looking back, it was autistic ADHD burnout. It was this piece of if you can't be yourself in the world, then it's incredibly stressful, and your body can only hold that load for so long before something tips out of balance. So, autistic and ADHD burnout are very real things. But yeah, that not just like scare people, but it's like that can be the eventual outcome of that constant, because you're essentially stepping beyond what your body can actually do. You're stepping beyond the resources your body has.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad that you brought that up because that is part of your background and part of the work of OHC and can't be overlooked. I mean, there's a lot of different ways that people can arrive at that high stress overfunctioning that's just going to totally take out your system. And neurodivergence is certainly one of them, if not accepted and integrated into your life in a way that helps you respond in a way that works for you. Lee Harbor, how can people find out more about you and your work?
I mean, currently it would just be through the clinic. So I work for the psychology team at the Optimum Health Clinic. And I don't sort of wouldn't say I specialize in neurodivergent work with neurodivergent individuals, but I think it's definitely an area I'm developing and would like to move into further. Because there is a large crossover between fatigue as a sort of fatigue and neurodivergence. And actually the fatigue community is overrepresented by neurodivergent individuals. So so it would be a case of just coming through the clinic. And if you particularly wanted to work with neurodivergence and that side, then you could request to work with myself. So yeah, that would be the best way currently.
Fantastic. Lee Harward, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, no, you're welcome. It was yeah, it's a pleasure to share this. I really want I just want people to be able to know that there are things they can do to, I guess, be empowered. It's not always looking for an expert. There are things we can do ourselves. It's just we need to, I guess, the right piece of guidance.
And you've given everybody plenty of things to start with today. So thanks again, Lee.
Great. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed watching this interview with one of our practitioner team here at the Optimum Health Clinic. You may not be aware that the Optimum Health Clinic is a sister organization to Conscious Life, which is hosting and producing this online conference. If you want to find out more about the work that we do here at the Optimum Health Clinic, you can request a free information pack. You can also book a free discovery call by going to our website, which is www.theoptimumhealthclinic.com. Thanks for watching.